Hello, it is now 5 o'clock here at CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and you are listening to The Corridor, bringing you local and regional news from Kingston and the surrounding area, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and for our podcasts, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. Thank you for joining us. And welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering Kingston City Council's approval of new funds for Queen's University's Tricolor Labs.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m. Or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. Council has unanimously approved $3 million in funding for the development of Tricolor Labs, a shared, industry-ready wet lab and biomanufacturing facility planned for Botterill Hall at Queen's University. Ben McGillwam with Kingston Economic Development Corporation spoke to the demand for the facility and the benefit of having it in Kingston.
So the primary users of the lab are going to be fully funded, commercializing stage life sciences companies looking for lab space, spinouts from the university and the college, and then other regional spinouts looking for BSL2 lab space, and scaling life science companies within the region, looking for short-term leases anywhere from 10 weeks to over a year. And then foreign direct investments looking for lab space to enter the North American market, kind of hitting the ground running. Tricolor Labs addresses a clear market demand across Ontario. There's a lack of wet lab space, especially the BSL2 for companies. And Kingston in particular has a severe lack of this space. The Tricolor Labs will integrate quite well with the Kingston ecosystem. The strengths that are Queen's University, the biotech program that's at St. Lawrence College, and the city's vision for a long-term health campus around a new hospital. This will be a feeder to that space. Kingston has a strong area of research and early stage innovation in the life sciences. We have programs like Dun & Desponsay's Queen's Innovation, a build-to-scale life science program where we see companies spinning out IP from the university into new businesses. Leveraging the research strengths that's at Queen's University and a lot of the equipment that is there that life science companies want.
Jesse Coobs with Economic Development at Queen's University also spoke before Council to how Queen's is uniquely positioned to meet this demand for lab space.
Queen's University is uniquely positioned to host Tricolor Labs. It has established programs and offers entrepreneurial and IP support necessary for early stage companies. The campus has established BSL 1 and 2 wet lab infrastructure, specialized equipment, and full biosafety and waste management framework already in place. It also has state-of-the-art animal facilities that help bridge the preclinical gap that often exists for startups. And importantly, Queen leads numerous clinical trials locally and internationally, meaning companies have the ability to plug directly into clinical research pathways as well. The eighth floor of Botterill Hall provides an ideal foundation for Tricolor Labs footprint. It already contains existing BSL 1 and 2 wet lab space, autoclaves, fume hoods, waste systems, all connected by secure card access hallways. The vision is to update and modernize the existing space into flexible modular suites similar to smart labs style facilities that are in global innovation centers, enabling multiple firms to collate safely with direct access to Queen's core facilities. Second floor is another area that's been designated with an open concept layout, growth-friendly space, ideal for companies looking for collaborative and scalable workspace. Shared equipment that is essential that would be cost prohibitive for companies, but it allow companies to grow and collaborate.
McGillwam and Coobs were given another opportunity to highlight the university's unique positioning for this project when asked by council how much this project would cost without the existing infrastructure at Queen's.
So I think the ballpark of that would be around 1,500 $1,000 a square foot. Just to renovate it was over $1,000 a square foot, plus the planning and permitting, and then finding the space that would fit the needs.
I'll just add quickly, to set up a biosafety level 2 building without the infrastructure would be millions and millions of dollars. The opportunity here is that we'll leverage existing infrastructure that is multi-million dollars of equipment and already established programs that we can leverage.
The funding is conditional on securing and maintaining additional government funding, finalizing governance and oversight structures, and executing formal funding and collaboration agreements between the City of Kingston, Kingston Economic Development Corporation, and Queen's University. The city's contribution will be limited to capital and equipment costs only, with no responsibility for operating, maintenance, or lifecycle expenses. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Coming up next, we have a story read by CFRC's Henry Walker, written by Michelle Dory Forestell, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for The Kingstonist, on local support for guests from the Keshetchewan community.
Thank you, Dinah. More than a month after arriving in Kingston, residents from Keshetchewan First Nation are still living in hotel rooms far from home, adjusting to unfamiliar routines, coping with uncertainty, and navigating the emotional strain of displacement. More than 250 people from the Northern Ontario Cree community were relocated to Kingston beginning Sunday, January 11, 2026, after a critical failure in Keshetchewan's water system left residents without safe drinking water. Many are considered Tier 1 or especially vulnerable evacuees, including elders, young families, and individuals with complex medical needs. At the center of local response is the Kingston Native Center and Language Nest, also known as KNCLN, which has been coordinating cultural supports, programming, and community connections for displaced people. For Executive Director Brandon Markle, the situation is both deeply personal and painfully familiar. When families first arrive, they cope, Markle said. But as the days turn into weeks, it takes a toll on your spirit, mind, and emotions. Our role at KNCLN is to soften the impact, to make sure people feel supported, connected, and cared for while they are here. In the days leading up to the relocation, KNCLN staff moved quickly to prepare for what they expected would not be a short-term emergency. The organization connected with local hotels to discuss accommodations, drawing on lessons learned from previous evacuations elsewhere in Ontario, where cultural needs and trauma-informed supports were not always fully integrated. These conversations help staff anticipate the realities of longer stays, including the importance of culturally appropriate food, access to community gathering spaces, and emotional supports for families facing prolonged uncertainty. Markle explained, "We knew from past evacuations that you can't treat this like a temporary overnight situation," he said. "People need stability, dignity, and a sense of belonging." When the first families arrived at the airport, KNCLN staff and volunteers were there to meet them, including Cree speakers who could offer greetings in their first language. Some staff came on their own time, bringing hot food to provide comfort after long travel days. "The first moment matters," Markle said. "It sets the tone that you are not alone, that you are entering a community that sees you as a family." Despite those efforts, daily life remains challenging for many evacuees. Most are living in hotel rooms with small kitchenettes, sharing tight quarters as they adjust to unfamiliar foods, routines, and surroundings. For children, particularly those with complex health or developmental needs, the disruption can be especially difficult. Imagine moving a family with children who have autism or other needs into a small hotel room in the city they've never been to, Markle said. Even with support, it's incredibly overwhelming. To help address those pressures, KNCLN began offering hot meals at the center, including foods that reflect traditional diets. Programming has also expanded into evenings and weekends, creating opportunities for Keshetchewan residents to gather, socialize, and reconnect with cultural practices. The organization also worked with the emergency management contractor, the Lumex Group, coordinating the relocation to ensure shuttle routes included the Native Center, making it easier for families to access resources and supports and services. Markle said the community response has been strong. To quote, "I was honestly overwhelmed by how many volunteers and organizations reached out to ask how they could help, and then followed through," he said. "There's been a real effort to make sure families feel welcome." He added that local partners have helped families navigate services, providing culturally appropriate meals, supported education needs, and focused on responding to community requests rather than imposing solutions. At KNCLN, staff intentionally refer to displaced residents as kin rather than evacuees, language that reflects Indigenous approaches to community and belonging. Indigenous kinship isn't as nuclear as Western models, Markle said. These are neighbors joining our community, not just evacuees passing through. Rather than offering one-size-fits-all services, staff focus on responding to families' requests and building trust over time, what Markle describes as moving at the speed of a relationship. We don't assume we know what people need, he said. We listen, we build relationships, and we respond. One of the greatest challenges remains the uncertainty surrounding how long families will be displaced. Markle said that the Mushtagowuk Council Grand Chief and the Chief of the Keshachewan First Nation traveled to Kingston to meet with evacuees and provide updates on water testing and next steps, but timelines remain unclear. The hardest part right now is the waiting, Markle said. People don't know when they'll be able to get home, and that uncertainty creates a lot of stress. Displacement has also separated extended families relocated to different cities, including Niagara Falls, where roughly 900 people are staying. Markle said that separation carries particular weight within Indigenous communities, where extended kinship networks play a central role in daily life. He also emphasized that Cree culture and experiences differ significantly from those of other Indigenous nations, cautioning against treating Indigenous communities as a single group. He said the Cree have a distinct approach to communication, decision-making, and family relationships, differences that can shape how displacement is experienced and underscore the need for culturally informed supports. When families are spread across multiple cities, that's another layer of trauma, he said. Keshachewan's water emergency is the latest in a series of recurring infrastructure challenges facing the remote community along the Albany River near James Bay. Like many First Nations reserves, the community was established on land chosen for colonial convenience rather than environmental sustainability, Markle said. Residents have faced repeated flooding, water treatment failures, and ongoing relocation discussions for decades. You're talking about thousands of people leaving with repeated disruptions, flooding, water issues, and now the prospect of relocating their entire community, Markle pointed out. That level of instability would be unimaginable for most municipalities. He added that in southern communities, such as Kingston or Napanee, similar infrastructure failures would likely be addressed quickly rather than persisting for years. KNCLN says it will continue providing meals, programming, cultural supports, transportation access, and advocacy for as long as families remain in Kingston. Kingston has really stepped up, Markle said. What matters most now is sustaining that care and understanding while families navigate something that is deeply difficult and uncertain.
Thank you, Henry, and thank you to Michelle Dory Forstel for that story. Coming up, CFRC student intern Juliana Gonsalves will read a story from Keith Dempsey, LGI reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, about the town of Gananoque's efforts to recruit new physicians.
Thank you, Dinah. Gananoque Council has approved a plan to fund physician recruitment incentives directly through the municipal tax levy as a part of the 2026 operating budget, aiming to strengthen efforts to attract family doctors to the community. In doing so, the town has joined other communities in the area who have adopted special tax measures in recent years to fund different aspects of healthcare, including Brockville and the United Counties of Leeds and Grenville. Council supported a resolution to create a dedicated budget line for the town's Physician Experiential Locum Grant Policy and Physician Recruitment Grant Program, two initiatives designed to encourage physicians to practice. Under the motion, the town will allocate up to $42,500 annually from the general tax levy to support the programs, beginning with the 2026 budget. The decision comes as funding for municipal grants tied to casino slot revenue has declined, reducing the amount available for community initiatives and physician recruitment incentives that previously relied on the funding source. Gananoque first introduced experiential locum grant policy in August 2023 to help bring physicians to the community on a trial basis, allowing them to experience practicing locally before committing long-term. A broader physician recruitment grant program was later established in July 2024, further to support attracting doctors to serve local residents. In addition to securing ongoing funding for physician recruitment, Council also approved reinstating the town's community grants program, allocating $42,500 for that initiative in the 2026 operating budget. The measures are intended to ensure stable, predictable funding for both physician attraction efforts and community grants, despite fluctuating casino revenues.
Thank you, Juliana, and thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Coming up next, we have a story by Ted Evans, LGI reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, about the outcomes of Loyalist Township's determinations about the conduct of a town councillor.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
Loyalist Township Council heard a presentation about two formal complaints alleging that Councillor Jake Ennis contravened the township's code of conduct while supporting the appeal of a recent ward boundary bylaw. The final integrity report found that Ennis did not contravene the code. In May 2025, Council enacted a bylaw to establish a new ward boundary configuration. The bylaw was then appealed to the Ontario Land Tribunal by a township resident, and in December 2025, the tribunal repealed the bylaw. Integrity Commissioner with Ayrton Burliss LLP, John Mascarin, explained the complaints.
There were two complaints that were filed on September the 17th and 18th. They were formal complaints filed under the Code of Conduct. Both complaints raised virtually identical allegations against the councillor. They asserted that he contravened two sections, sections 2.2 and section 4.1H of the code, by publicly opposing the bylaw and actively supporting the appeal to the Ontario Land Tribunal. Specifically, the complaints alleged that the councillor promoted fundraising efforts, including a GoFundMe campaign to finance the appeal of the bylaw before the tribunal. There were allegations that the councillor attempted to find a straw person to file the appeal, and that his wife led the fundraising efforts. The complainants asserted that the councillor member's conduct in doing all of these things demonstrated a lack of respect for council's decision-making process and amounted to a covert attempt to undermine a council decision that he did not support.
Ms. Guerin talked about their decision-making process.
We refer to the standard of proof. It's on a civil standard, which is a balance of probabilities. So it's not like a criminal standard where it's beyond a reasonable doubt. All we have to do is find that we believe that the member may be more likely than not have contravened the code, and we could find a contravention. In this case, we did not find that. We found that it was the opposite. Our review of the materials and the evidence appeared to point to the member being entitled to do what he did without contravening the code.
Ms. Guerin talked about another case that influenced their decision.
One of the main reasons that we've made our determination is based on an Ontario Divisional Court decision in Jubenville versus Chatham-Kent. And that involved a decision of the municipality of Chatham-Kent, and Councillor Jubenville fighting against the decision and continuing to disagree with the decision afterwards. And that was brought before the Integrity Commissioner in Chatham-Kent. And the Integrity Commissioner made a determination on a provision that is very, very similar to the one that is at play in this matter. And in that case, the Integrity Commissioner felt that Councillor Jubenville's efforts to fight against the decision of council to seek an overturning of council's decision was wrong and unreasonable. And that went to court. And the court said the integrity commissioner's determination was itself unreasonable and overturned the decision.
Mascarin explains why this case may be even stronger.
In this particular case, it's an even stronger indication because there is an as-of-right appeal to any person to be able to file an appeal. We believe that the determination in Jubinville aligns very, very closely to this particular instance. And in fact, this case may be even stronger because there is an as-of-right appeal to bring forward an appeal to the Ontario Land Tribunal from a ward boundary review bylaw.
Mascarin detailed their final conclusion.
Our ultimate determination is that Councillor Innes did not breach the Code of Conduct Section 4.1H, and that is our determination. We did not feel that he disrespected Council's decision. He had a different view, and he attempted to use his rights at law to counter that, whether it was working with someone helping forward with the matter. Our conclusion is, on a balance of probabilities, we are not satisfied that Councillor Innes failed to respect Council's decision-making process in accordance with the specific wording of the Code of Conduct. His conduct consisted solely of publicly expressing disagreement and supporting a lawful appeal process, and perhaps efforts to propagate a different view from Council.
Innes speaks about the importance of the decision.
I think the commissioner's decision is an important one. It offers needed clarity on the code for members and for members of the public. I think the opportunity probably exists or may exist for loyalist staff and council at some point in the future to consider updating loyalist code of conduct to ensure that its language is clear and current in light of this decision and in comparison to the codes of other municipalities. I think it's worth noting that it's not just this complainant that had this notion that, you know, once council makes a decision, councillors are compelled to agree with it or remain silent. I can remember doing AMO, you know, introduction to being a councillor type training in my first year, and the instructor there referred to the same old notion. You know, even then, I didn't obviously agree with it, with the notion. For me, it was clear and is clear that I did not run for council to remain silent when I disagree with the majority of council. I ran for council to, in my view, represent the public interest. I think this decision and the related OLT or bylaw decision are two important positives for the advancement of democratic principles in Loyalist Township.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Coming up next, we have Brenda Little, LGI reporter for CJPE County FM in Picton, covering the future of family farming in Prince Edward County.
Agriculture has always been an important part of Prince Edward County, where generations of families have been producing food for the region and beyond. But things are changing. Rising costs, climate change, labor shortages, and lack of succession are squeezing farmers and eroding profitability. Prince Edward County's Economic and Development Team examined four sectors, including farm market, apples and grapes, on-farm diversification, and future of the family farm. Economic Development Officer Karen Palmer tells us more.
Karen, you've been running some surveys and some workshops over the last couple of months. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So we do something every year called a business retention and expansion survey. So we usually do it by sectors, and this year happens to be on the agricultural sector. So we start with a digital or online survey that kind of gives us an overview of biggest challenges and sort of the makeup of the sector. And then we've been adding in some focus groups to try and drill down on some of the issues that have been raised.
What will you do with the information?
Well, we're just getting started. So we've done the survey, the four focus groups, and now I need to do some one-on-one outreach, really get some deeper understanding of certain sectors or certain subsectors, I guess I should say. Usually what I tend to do is we do a data analysis of the stuff that has come in through the online survey, and then I tend to write a report for council outlining these are some of the issues that we need to be aware of that are happening in the sector, both barriers or challenges and opportunities, and look at the ways in which the municipality might think about supporting different things. So, you know, at today's session, we heard about the farmers market. So is there a way that the municipality could expand or make space available for a four-season market? Some things that are a little stickier, you know, around land use and other things. But I think what the next step over this process is really talking internally even about, here's what we've heard, now what do we do?
And then, of course, there's restrictions with the province. I mean, it's one thing for the municipality to say, okay, we can change this, this, or this, but they've also got restrictions with the province, right?
That's right. It's more complicated than you would think it would be. And sometimes it's, I mean, I think one of the things that really came through at today's session is that even with, you know, you're hearing at one table, it'd be nice if severances were easier so that when our farm is struggling, we could get a little bit of money from a land sale. And then you hear at the next table, we wish there were not as many severances because it's harder for our farm to expand if there are all these houses around it. So within this sector, there's a lot of differing opinions. And I think that's something that we need to kind of do a little bit more exploration around.
And you had broken this down into four sectors. So there was the farmers market, apple and grape growers, mm-hmm. diversification, and then, of course, the farmers today. And they all come with a different slant, I would think.
They do. I mean, you think about the scale at the farmers market level versus the scale at what we would have heard today. Yeah, there's much different challenges no matter which little part you're in. And I think for, you know, we sort of pulled out the wine growers for the simple reason that right now almost half of them are looking at, they either are for sale or they're looking at going for sale. And to me, that spells that we've got a little bit of an issue there that we need to be looking at in terms of succession. And since the wine sector is so important to the tourism sector, it can have a knock-on effect if we start to lose that.
Do you think changes can be made as a result of all of this?
I mean, I think there's lots of different things we can be thinking about. I think it helps us to know what people are talking about. I think for me, this feels like a sector. I grew up on a farm, but I feel like I know very little about it here. So it's excellent to kind of get this sense of differing perspectives. I think there's lots of things that internally we can think about in terms of some of it's cultural. When someone comes to you and says, I want to do this, how do we have that conversation without making it formal off the bat? How do we make it so that there is a little bit more back and forth between someone who wants to do something on their land versus someone who's working in government? So I think that's all part of the internal conversations of. And I would also say, you know, Prince Edward County has undergone such a tremendous change. I'm part of it too. I only moved here 8 years ago. So when you think about folks who are moving into this place and they love it because it's bucolic and beautiful, but they may not understand that also at certain times of year, there is a lot of heavy machinery on the roads, that there are calves that are crying for their mamas because they're being weaned. I think there's lots of things we can do to help people just understand farming better and help farmers coordinate, you know, tours or getting people onto farming scenarios that might help them learn a little bit more about mm-hmm. what farming actually is. Yeah.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.